Welcome to Bergenomics, demystifying economics with Ross McDowell.
Welcome to the Bergenomics podcast, where we demystify economics. I'm your host, Ross McDowell. Electric vehicles, are they inevitable? To help me answer that question, with me today is one of Australia's leading electric vehicle experts, Mr. Bryce Gatton. Bryce consults to government and the private sector on fleet transition to electric vehicles through his consultancy EV Choice. Bryce also supervises at Melbourne University School of Engineering in relation to electric vehicles. He has been prolific in writing on electric vehicles since 2008, and you may have read some of his insightful articles in the motoring media. Bryce, welcome to Bergenomics.
Oh, thank you, Ross. Well, thank you for welcoming me here today.
Now, Bryce, there are 20 million hybrid and electric cars on the world's roads. That figure is set to double by the end of 2023. In the US, EV sales have just reached 5% of total new car sales, which is the same sort of percentage as in Europe and in China. Yet, in Australia, we have one of the slowest uptakes of EV cars, electric vehicles, in the world. It's less than 1%. The Australian Bureau of Statistics puts the average age of an internal combustion engine car, a petrol car or a diesel car, which we all drive, on Australian roads at 11 years. So even with an increasing electric vehicle take-up rate, the majority of cars on Australian roads in 2050 will statistically still be running on petrol. So the question I would put to you is, are electric vehicles inevitable for all Australians, and if so, when?
Yes, is the simple answer to that. When is basically the outcome of a, curve, and a increasing exponential curve, because they're not going to take off in a linear fashion, they take off in an exponential fashion. All these transitions happen that way. Yeah. At the start of last century, transition from horse and cart to petrol was actually done in about 10, 13, 12 years. There's two famous photographs, one of was Fifth Avenue in New York at 1900, and there's one petrol car, all horses and carriages. 13 years later, you can see one horse and carriage and everything else is petrol cars and more traffic on the road. So when a transition happens, it basically starts off slowly as the technology develops and people start buying it and get the early adopters, and that sort of leading of people to this new technology, and then people start to realize how much better it is, and then start buying it in numbers, manufacturers start producing it, get the economies of scale up enough to get the prices down, and you get takeoff. We've seen it in mobile phones, we've seen it in flushing toilet, we've seen it in a refrigerator, you name it, all of those technologies start off slowly, very expensive. A classic example is the plasma / LCD TV. I remember first seeing one of those at JB Hi-Fi, not a very big size, for $37,000. And now they're generally under $1,000.
Okay, so if you do believe it's inevitable that all Australians drive electric vehicles, that will require them eventually to dispose of their petrol or internal combustion engine vehicles. Yet recently, there's a production facility that has been proposed for just outside Burnie in Tasmania and one in Chile that produces net zero emission fuel suitable for all existing petrol vehicles that's made with used carbon in terms of the energy to make it. Does that weaken the case for electric vehicles at all, that they can produce a fuel now that is emission-free?
Not at all. It'll give a impetus to keeping classic cars on the road, but those fuels don't scale. If you start using them for or growing them for productive lands, you start taking up food production land instead of for fuel production, which is actually already been ruled out as a no-no. In terms of the world's population and trying to feed them, you can't produce enough fuel by growing it to burn in a car in a very inefficient manner. You're looking at 25 to 40% depending on the type of fuel you're burning in an internal combustion engine, efficiencies, versus electric where you're getting up around 90-something%. So an electric car is much more efficient, uses the energy in a much more, you know, palatable fashion, I suppose, so to use a lot less energy to move the car the same distance.
So this new fuel they're developing, you see that really just for classic cars or
becoming niche. It could be classic cars, it could be a transition fuel for aircraft, because that's one of the difficult ones. That'll be one of the later ones to transition, although some aircraft are moving to electric and other forms now.
Okay. Let's move to talking about the cost of running an electric vehicle versus a internal combustion engine vehicle. In the US, EVs are 25% cheaper to run than their comparable internal combustion engine vehicles, and $2,000 cheaper in maintenance over 5 years. Yet I've seen studies in Australia that have estimated that you need to be driving twice the national average of 12,000 kilometres per year, it's 24,000 kilometres, for 5 years, and charging with solar panels to make up for the electric vehicle's much higher initial purchase cost.
Partially true. America has very cheap fuel, so that would make the economy spread out over the time. We have much more expensive fuel. In fact, most of the world has much more expensive fuel. Second part of that is you don't have to run it on solar and things in Australia to get that economy. You're looking at about, in terms of direct fuel cost, roughly a quarter of the cost of petrol will be your electricity, as if you're running off the grid. And that's if you're using it as a, not picking the peak time to charge it, like going to the petrol station at the peak of the cycle. You wouldn't do that, but you've got a lot more control with an electric car. You can get it to charge off peak rates quite good. You can get it to charge off your own solar, which is effectively free if you do the cost of the solar system amortized over its lifespan. I think it works at about 6 cents a kilowatt as the minimum, even running on your own solar, up to, you know, 15, 18 cents for a good off-peak rate, or versus 40 cents plus for some of the particularly high peak rates. So it depends on, you have control of the price cycle for your electricity, but it's not entirely true to say that it would be 5 years at solar. But it is true about the double the distance at the moment to amortise your extra expense to begin with.
So then that initial purchase cost is so big that on a pure economic basis, EV cars are in the realm of higher socioeconomic people that can afford them.
This is one of the arguments I have against subsidies at the moment, because you're actually subsidising the richer people to buy EVs, where you're actually not actually getting the cars to the people that should be driving them, but should be able to access them, which they can't at the moment. So lower economic groups can't afford electric cars at the moment. Other ways of subsidising EVs, like governments buying the cars and turning them over at their normal pace rather than the longer pace that figure says. You keep them a bit longer so you get the economy of keeping them for longer, make them reach the break-even point.
Yeah.
The ACT government is actually deliberately buying them and turning them over at their normal rate in order to get them into the second-hand market, so that lower economic group can actually afford them.
Okay. So, to put it in a very practical day-to-day sense, if I have a petrol car and it's got a 60-litre tank and I fill it full of petrol at today's prices is going to be somewhere north of $120 to fill that tank, and let's say that tank gets me 400 kilometres, 450 kilometres.
Yes, the average fuel economy of Australian cars is going up at the moment, so it's up to about 12 litres per 100 kilometres. It's actually because we're buying heavier, less efficient vehicles in terms of the petrol cars. It's actually getting worse rather than better. And that's partly to do with government policy of not bringing in fuel quality or fuel economy standards.
Right, because as a country we have, I believe, in terms of emission standards from ICE engines, the least stringent emission standards.
Pretty much within the OECD, yes.
So we tend to get vehicles imported, because we are totally imported vehicles now, we get imported vehicles that other countries wouldn't sell.
Yeah, you're not allowed to sell them in Europe or in other countries now, but they can still bring them here.
Right. So if we
digressed on that point.
No. So if we have a look at our tank of petrol at $120 and it's going to get us 400 kilometres, comparatively with an electric vehicle, what's that going to cost me?
Two answers. One is, if you're charging it from home, probably roughly a quarter, so $30.
Right.
And there are a number of free charging points and things, so the more penny-pinching amongst us do like to find some of those occasionally. Yep. But generally speaking, if you're driving across the Nullarbor, which I did recently from Melbourne to Perth and back, you'll be using the public charge, not public, the private networks that would charge you at roughly 40 cents-ish a kilowatt hour for charging, so that would maybe about one half to two thirds the cost of petrol. But I still spent driving Melbourne to Perth all up, because I was charging at some of the caravan parks and things I was staying at, so you get generally free electricity there. I think I spent somewhere around $200 each way.
Right.
So, which I think is about $800 or $900, I think a few people sort of said would be in a car.
Okay. So this initial additional premium that is charged for electric vehicles, that does keep it in the realm of the higher socioeconomic group, making it, and a lot of people would probably go, well, electric vehicles aren't practical yet because they're not cheap enough.
Ah, but they are getting cheaper. The cheapest ones you can get now is the MG, with a reasonable range around, I think the new battery is around 350-ish kilometre range, and it's under 50 grand, so it's about 47 or 8,000. So they're not cheap as yet, but they're certainly not in the Tesla prices anymore that used to be around 100.
Okay. Now, with the range anxiety argument and the recharging discussions about solar panels and using the grid, etc., what does it cost to install the various levels of home recharging units?
Ah, that's a good question. You can charge off a PowerPoint, but you need to have that PowerPoint connected directly to the switchboard, because an ordinary PowerPoint circuit would be having a few connections along the way, and it's never a good thing because they're drawing current for a very long time. I always recommend not charging off a PowerPoint except for the occasional motel or caravan park type visit, because 3-pin plugs were never meant to take 10 amps for 20, 15, whatever hours. And they eventually come a little bit loose, and as they get loose, that's basically increasing the resistance in the joint. And for anyone with a bit of science content and the knowledge there, resistance equals heat. The more resistance, the hotter it gets, and they very rapidly deteriorate and melt. And I have various pictures of destroyed plugs from people using them for EV charging. If you're going to put an EV charger in at home, put in a dedicated charger with a proper EV plug, and they're made for good solid connections and last, I think they test up to 10,000 disconnects, reconnects.
And what does that cost?
If you're putting in a PowerPoint, 15 amp PowerPoint, put in an industrial type one that will screw the plug onto it, and that will cost about $500 installed, taken back to the switchboard. For a full EV SE, electric vehicle supply equipment, effectively an automatic PowerPoint, it will cost $1,500 up installed, depending on the charger you select. So the cheapest chargers are around $800-ish, but you can go up to $4,000 if you want one that sings and dances and does everything on your mobile phone.
And some EVs have different capacities to charge quicker or not quicker. Mm. I think Porsche have a different system or a different charge rate. Going to an average system that you would have in a home, how long is it going to take to recharge your vehicle?
Ah, the lovely answer to that is there's no average. Charging is no longer a one-size-fits-all model, like a petrol station. You stand there in the rain or wind or whatever and act as your fuel pump attendant and it fills up and what have you. That's a one-speed type system. For an electric car, you can choose at what rate it charges at, so how long it takes. For a PowerPoint, my Kona would take something like 28 hours to fully charge, which would be a severe pain, but useful in an emergency. For a home charger at 32 amps, is about 9 hours, and that's overnight. So I always say charging at home takes me 20 seconds. 10 seconds to plug in when I get home, 10 seconds to unplug when I... The charging time as such is irrelevant.
Okay.
But fast charging is another area where on the road, you can plug into these DC fast chargers, and for the fastest speeds at the moment, like an Ioniq 5, Hyundai Ioniq 5, is just under 18 minutes to go from 0 to 80% charge.
Do people have the mentality, because they've been driving petrol cars the whole time, we need to fill up, and so as you fill up your tank 100% with fuel, they have the mentality that they need to recharge their battery to 100%, whereas maybe they don't, because they're only travelling, I think, what the average kilometres travelled per day in Australia is, I think it's somewhere 12 or...
It's in the 30 kilometre-ish. 30. Melbourne's, I think, 32 or 38 kilometres.
The people are driving to and from. Okay. And so
average, by the way. Some people do a lot more than that.
A lot more. So there, you don't need to have your battery fully charged. Mm. It doesn't need to sit for endless hours. You can just top it up.
Yep. And most people don't refill at the petrol station every day to 100%. They might do that every couple of weeks.
Right.
That's so they will run it down to a quarter or less, or sometimes people run until the light comes on, and then they refill. And that's pretty much what an electric car is the same. You can let it run down to, say, 10 or 20%, and then you top it up. And if you want to get the cheapest electricity rate, you just set the timer. Say, oh, there's a 4-hour particular window in my electricity tariff. It'll charge 4 hours today, 4 hours tomorrow. There's an 8-hour window that I can get pretty much a full charge.
Okay. The battery that powers the electric vehicles, what's the life of the battery?
That's a very good question. That's also a bit of a how long is a piece of string, because they have several lives. First life is in the car, and the manufacturers generally guarantee them for up to for 8 years to a minimum of 70% remaining range. So if you have a car that's 420, so Kona, for instance, has a 480 kilometre range, knock 30% off that, so 150, so you're down to 330 after 8 years, and this is worst case scenario. Many people may not even notice that, so you don't have to replace the battery after 8 years. Worst case scenario is 70%. Anything less than that, you get a free new battery.
Right. To replace the battery, what will that cost?
Ah, I hadn't quite finished. So first up, it is more than 8 years to replace it.
Yep.
Quite possibly you will never replace it.
Right.
Because that's worst case scenario is 70%. You might not hit that point until 10, 12, 15 years old.
Does it go on usage that the battery deteriorates, or time?
Bit of both. So there's just a general time degradation, and a bit of, if you use it a lot and cycle it a lot, they're guaranteed for several thousand cycles. So full charge, discharge cycles, which if you work it out, I think 2,000 is a sort of an average sort of number. That works out to something like, if you're doing that once, even once a week, 2,000 works out to like, you can do the maths, a lot. Yeah. You're looking at 50 a year. So 15 to 2,000 will give you how many years.
Yeah, okay. So I interrupted you. Go on.
Yes. So that's the first part is the battery may not be doesn't require replacing after 8 years. It's not like sort of the warranty expires, the motor's stuffed, or the battery's stuffed. You don't replace the motor in a car when the warranty expires. They often go forever. The second part is those batteries then have a second life. So when they're pulled out, they go into storage systems because they have a much gentler life in there, and they might last another 10, 15 years there. Then they'll go into recycling. So backtracking now to what's the cost of a new battery. When the first Leafs came out, they were about $60,000 for a car with 120-ish, 130 kilometre range. So that was where range anxiety first came from. And they cost, if you had to replace it within the warranty period, they charged about $30,000, which was nuts. But that was also early battery technology development. They're now about $10,000 to replace by a Nissan dealer. The Hyundai Kona is about $32,000 for a new battery. Again, everything at the moment will be replaced on the warranty if there was a problem. In fact, my battery isn't being replaced on the warranty fairly soon. And that's due to there was about 15 or 16 car fires around the world, and Hyundai decided to replace about 70,000 batteries in the early batch for free.
So
I would predict, and this is just a prediction, that with the economies of scale of battery production in 10 years' time, if I want to replace the battery in the Kona, it might be equivalent to the Nissan now at about $10,000.
And when the battery no longer serves its purpose for an electric vehicle, the owner of the vehicle has to make the decision, do I sell the vehicle or do I get a new battery?
Mm.
And do you believe that there will be a market for second-hand batteries?
Yes, and market for upgraded systems created by aftermarket people. There's a company in Queensland at the moment selling a upgraded battery for the Mitsubishi iMEV. It originally had about 120 kilometre range. These are 2010, 2011 model sort of cars. They're getting towards needing batteries replaced now. He's offering a battery that will do 220 to 240 kilometres range for, I think it was 12,250 fitted.
Okay.
So it gives it a whole new life, double the range it originally had.
And eventually the battery does become unusable and has to be recycled. Mm. What sort of value is within a battery to recycle it? Is it still full of rare
minerals? Yes, it's full of what they call rare earth minerals. One of the big things about rare earths is most of them aren't that rare. That's a bit of a misnomer. But the lithium, cobalt, all those minerals can be recycled out of it, and they say about 96% recyclable. Tesla, in fact, said their system is set up that it will be fully recycling their batteries. So after about 2050, when all EVs are, well, sorry, all vehicles are electric vehicles, all vehicles are electric, get that right, it will basically be, there won't be the massive mining required, it'll just be a topping up mining. So they'll be topping up with lithium and maybe cobalt, although cobalt itself is being phased out.
Okay. The big question that people always seem to want to talk about with electric vehicles is, if you look at the manufacturer of an electric vehicle and the emissions required to manufacture it, manufacture the battery, the whole thing.
So cradle to grave.
Yeah. Replacement of the battery till the vehicle is no longer usable and junked.
Mm.
Is the electric vehicle more climate change friendly than the comparable internal combustion engine car from cradle to grave?
Very much so. There have been a number of papers published on this particular topic because it's basically a particularly big urban myth that the EV trolls do like to promote, that, you know, they're more polluting than an internal combustion car, and it's simply not true. The in Europe, they've said that the payback period for the manufacturer side of the vehicle is about, trying to remember, 2 years or a bit less. I think it's about 2 years in Europe because they have a lower distance driven each year. America say it's about 9 to 18 months to pay back the actual manufacturer of the vehicle, and then it's reduced emissions effectively going down thereafter compared to the internal combustion engine car. So unless you junk your car every 9 months in America or every 2 years in Europe, you are doing better.
Well, that's a substantial argument for electric vehicles, isn't it? Because most people believe that electric vehicles, because they cost more, will take up more of the emissions to produce them.
Mm.
But you were saying the payback period is a lot shorter.
Yes. Union of Concerned Scientists in America have done a number of papers on it. There's a number of European Commission commissioned reports on the same topic.
If we talk about the recharging anxiety, which a lot of people say prevents them from buying an EV because they might travel to the country or they might live in the country, is that the handbrake to even the high socioeconomic groups of people purchasing an EV?
That's an interesting question, because how many people actually do that travel? So the city people, how many, they like to buy their Swiss Army knife car, so their big SUV, for toddling around the suburbs to drop the kids off to school and to sport. And that's about all they ever do, commuting back and forth to work. So they almost never go into the regional areas or remote areas. So it is a bit of a misnomer to actually say that, oh, my car doesn't do that. Well, my usual question is, how often do you actually do it? So you could actually, in a case once every few years, hire a car that would do that and buy a smaller car to begin with, so you'd save a lot of money. So that's part of it. For those that do live in the country, yes, it is an issue. I've just driven, as I spoke about a bit earlier, driving from Melbourne to Perth and back across the Nullarbor, and I had probably ended up adding about 2 days to the trip because there's this EV charging black hole between after Adelaide through to a couple hundred k's west of the border, at the WA border. It's about 1,400 kilometres with no DC fast charging. So I had to use, basically do roughly the range of my car, or stopping at the right spots, because they're actually quite remote places. So I did 200 k's one of those days, 300 the next. I did 500 the third, but I had to stop for 3 hours at a 32 amp outlet power point to get enough range to get there.
But you would expect that to change in the future, wouldn't
yes. you? Yes. Melbourne to Adelaide, drive there like a normal car, normal petrol car. Melbourne, I've done Melbourne, Canberra, Sydney, Coffs Harbour. When the bushfires started, I actually was coming back from Coffs Harbour to Melbourne, and this is in late 2019, and I could see the smoke coming up as I was heading down the highway. I looked at what's called an app called PlugShare to see where are the DC chargers, and the NRMA in New South Wales have built this nice skeletal network, which has increased further now, throughout New South Wales. And I went, yep, there's a charger at Tamworth and Dubbo, and I went from Coffs Harbour to Melbourne in 2 days. If you've got the DC chargers there, you drive as per normal, and my Kona charges at about three to a third of the rate that the current crop of cars are coming at DC.
So I understand the argument that most people don't use their vehicles to do the long distances, etc., that just about all of their driving is short distance in the city. But the human psychology is quite different.
They like their Swiss Army knife car, and I don't think you'll get them to stop buying
that. They buy four-wheel drives, but they don't need a four-wheel drive. They buy an SUV when a station wagon would be a much better choice. So they might want to go to the outback. They may never get there, but that may be their psychology. Is that the case for hybrids then, so that they can use, when they are 99% of the time running around the suburbs, use electric vehicle capacity of a hybrid, and then they can still have an internal combustion engine in the vehicle to take them to the outback if they wanted to go there?
Yeah, they have a good use case. A lot of the plug-in, and there's plug-in hybrids versus non-plug-in hybrids. Non-plug-in hybrids, we haven't talked about it yet, but there are actually bans coming on the sale of new internal combustion engine cars in various countries of the world. In Europe, it's to be 2035 blanket. Some countries there are much earlier. Norway's 2025, and it's almost game over for the internal combustion car there. But actually, I digress so far, I forgot what the question was. Hybrids, yes.
Yeah.
So plug-in hybrids versus hybrids. So hybrids will discount because they are basically a fuel-saving device. Right, if they run out of fuel, the car doesn't go. If a plug-in hybrid runs out of fuel, it will still run on the battery until the battery goes flat, because you can recharge via a plug. So I'm focusing on plug-in hybrids. They do have a good use case, but they have to be used within their use case, and a lot of them were sort of compliance cars where they could get the credits in European markets for being an electric vehicle and reducing the overall fuel use and emissions, but a bit like Dieselgate, except they were on the right side of the law. They sort of came up with very tiny batteries that met that requirement, but some of them got down to 12, 15, 20 kilometre range, which is almost useless unless you plug in pretty much at the end of every part of your commute during the day in Melbourne, which would drive you nuts. My Kona, I charge once every couple of weeks.
So do you see hybrids as maybe being the transitioning vehicle?
They have been, in, up until now, they're beginning to fade out. So in Norway, as I alluded to a moment ago, they is almost game over for the internal combustion car. It was reasonable numbers of plug-in hybrids and electric vehicles were being sold. The electric vehicle percentage, they're getting almost 90% of sales of cars with plugs then, plugs to charge now, and that proportion of battery electric vehicle versus plug-in hybrid electric vehicle is getting bigger and bigger towards the BEV. I think it's two-thirds or more. So it's almost the time that hybrid has passed, because the prices of a battery electric vehicle are also coming down as the economies of scale come in. So once that happens, the hybrid really has its limited use case. So unless you stick within the range that it has for the EV only, you tend to be lugging around a bigger, heavier car than you might have chosen otherwise. And you also got no savings in servicing and things, because you've now got two drivetrains to look after instead of the electric one only. So you've got to service the petrol car as per normal, plus whatever work that an electric car might want.
Requires. I have a friend, and he works in the agricultural industry and drives around to lots and lots of farms in Australia. Mm. What would he do in terms of electric vehicles, because he goes places 90% of the time that there is not going to be any infrastructure.
There won't be, well, it depends. If he hits the highway, there ultimately will be DC fast chargers somewhere along those paths, just as there are petrol stations now. So if he couldn't access a petrol station now, he'd have just as much difficulty as he would have with a petrol electric car. So it would be hitting the highways at some stage. So that's the first part of it. The second part, so that we need the more DC chargers to be put in, and that's slowly happening, and there's slowly being some government support, funding and support for that. Second part of the thing is, yes, if he's sticking really remote and knowing going to farms through the back paddocks, he's going to run out of petrol, or diesel in this case. So yes, he would probably use the farmer's diesel tank to top up, or he could use the farmer's 32 amp outlet. So whilst he's there, he just plugs into a 32 amp generator, which would also be run off diesel, of course, but the farmer might ultimately have some battery systems and things, so, or solar. So you could just as easily top up via electricity as you would by the farmer's diesel tank.
Okay.
Well, the car, oh yes, there is the cars that he might like though, the four-wheel drives and utes, aren't yet here. So he's still going to be driving the diesel for a while longer. But that's not far off.
Where we go to a petrol station these days, the nozzle is exactly the same fitting into our petrol tank.
Mm.
A super basic question. Electric vehicles and recharging stations, do they have the same connector?
I'm happy to announce the plug war is over. There were three competing systems. There was the CHAdeMO developed by the Japanese. There was the CCS, combined charging system, which is a consortium set up between a lot of car manufacturers and charger manufacturers. And there was Tesla with their proprietary plug. Tesla used their proprietary plug in America still, purely because of the strange electricity system they have over there. And I think it's America, parts of Japan, and South Korea, I think that plug is used. Everywhere else, for the Tesla Model Y and a Tesla Model 3, they've adopted the CCS plug. Europe has adopted the CCS plug, combined charging system plug. Australia has adopted the CCS plug. So we now, all new cars arriving here except for two, sorry, correction, all new cars arriving here use the AC plug, the same one, part of the CCS combined charging system. So it's a combined bit. The AC plug is the same, it's called a type 2 plug, and everybody uses it. So if you're charging off a home charger or the slower AC charger, public chargers, everybody's the same. For DC, pretty much everybody is the same using the CCS system, with the exception of the Nissan Leaf and the Lexus UX 300e, which use the old CHAdeMO still. Nissan giving up on the CHAdeMO system soon with the arrival of the Nissan Ariya. And I'm not sure what's happening with the Lexus, but I'm presuming that they will relent if they're the only one left. So effectively the plug war is over. Although all the new DC chargers still have both CCS and CHAdeMO to keep the older cars going, because some of the older Nissan Leafs and the iMEs all had, and some of the plug-in hybrids had the CHAdeMO. So plug war is over.
Let's turn to the manufacturer of electric vehicles. Are electric vehicles more profitable for manufacturers than the comparable internal combustion engine vehicles?
Two answers to that one. In theory, yes. In practice, no. In theory, they take about a third less labour and have a lot less parts going into them, like 17-ish parts into electric motor and the single reduction gear drivetrain, versus 500 plus for a typical internal combustion engine and gearbox, and all the labour involved in putting that together. So roughly a third less labour putting electric car together. So in theory, they should become, if you can get the components cheap enough, the economies of scale, get the battery prices down, what have you, they should get cheaper than a petrol car in the long run. In practice, though, manufacturers are struggling to build it and haven't got the economies of scale and have the legacy of all of their workforce and all of their machinery in their factories to change over. So there's this, effectively, what's coming is what you can call the valley of death between them slowing sales of petrol cars to keep their profits rolling in and being having the money to make the transition to build electric cars. That it will be quite profitable, but there's this huge period of dislocation in between. Tesla don't have to worry about it because they started off as EVs and that's what they build.
Yeah,
so there's already the other side.
You and I spoke the other day on the phone, didn't we, about manufacturers like General Motors down at Fisherman's Bend, and they had a foundry where they created the molten metal for a lot of the drivetrain on the vehicles.
They used to build the motors, the gearboxes, you know, the engine block casting, all that stuff.
All of those parts are not in an electric vehicle, and so the capital required to put together a factory would be less for electric vehicles than it would be for an internal combustion engine?
Well, if you look at Tesla's factories, they're quite expensive because they have highly automated. So if you look at those factories, they're quite scary in how few people there are and how many robots there are and what they do.
Right.
So they're very expensive factories to build still. But yeah, Tesla, I think I've heard they make like about 20% profit on their cars, which is almost unheard of in the automotive industry. So as I was saying, they are... But EVs can be very profitable, but you have to be in the right place at the right time, so to speak. So the legacy manufacturers have got that issue. And I have written in the past what's about called the Osborne effect, which is where in the 80s, I think it was, Osborne Computers, now defunct, for the reasons I'm about to explain, built this nice little home computer in the very early days and then announced the bigger and better and more powerful and cheaper one that was soon to come. So everyone stopped buying their computer, which meant they didn't have any money to put into the production development and start selling anyone, and they went broke. And Tesla, in some ways, have created that Osborne effect. So everyone goes, oh, there's these really good EVs. We would much prefer EVs to buying a petrol car because we know they're the future. So we'll stop buying petrol cars. As a result, there is this potential for everyone stopping buying new petrol cars already. So it could be an Osborne effect already happening with petrol cars. You can see new petrol car sales are, in fact, declining, which is always put down to the chip shortage, but I always scratch my head at that going, chip shortage doesn't seem to have affected the electric cars quite so much because their sales are skyrocketing even as we talk now. And secondhand prices of cars are going up. It's almost like people are buying the interim car, the car that it'll keep us going until I can get an electric car to price or the model niche that I need.
So there's a whole lot of issues creating added cost with electric vehicle being, at this stage, battery.
Hmm.
But there are also issues to say it will be cheaper to produce an electric vehicle, but they're going to occur further down the track after we lay off lots of workers, reduce the capacity or reduce the capital footprint of the factories and change people's thinking. So at the moment, not great in terms of profitability and
purchase price. If people keep buying the petrol cars, that's why I suspect Ford are focusing on all these SUVs and big high profit things. And Nissan are doing that here as well. They're focusing more on their high profit SUVs and big cars and have jettisoned all the small stuff already.
So, given that electric vehicles are quite homogeneous in terms of, from an engineering point of view...
I would tend to dispute that one.
Yeah.
In terms of... Well, I'll let you finish the rest of the question because I know where you're going with that one in terms of petrol cars have more different motors and platforms, but that's not really the case anymore. Manufacturers have for years been sharing platforms and motors across different marks. You know, VW Group, quite famous for doing that. Renault... do that. So it's just a continuation of what has been happening in the last 20, 30 plus years. If everybody, older people, remember the ultimate in that was a badge engineering of sharing the platform of the Toyota Lexan, which was a Holden Commodore with a Lexan badge stuck on, or the Ford Laser, which was a Mazda 323 with a Ford Laser badge and a few tweaks to the panel shapes. That's constantly going on and has been going for many years, and the same thing's happening with electric cars. Manufacturers are sharing platforms. There's so many alternatives, it's a bit hard to name any particular one, in fact. But they, like the Nissan Ariya and the Renault E-Tech Macan, are the same platform. But they're very different body shapes. But the same has happened with the Renault, I'm trying to think of the SUV, the big SUV they make, that's been around a while. That one was, in fact, also shared with the Nissan X-Trail.
Could we get to the situation where we have a couple of manufacturers that make the basic running platform and then other manufacturers add their body, their interior, their personality, yet the actual running frame is exactly the same?
Two answers to that. That's where motor vehicles first came from. You had the basically the chassis being brought in and the coach builders putting it on. That pretty much died with the economies of scale of manufacturers building them. And the other part of that answer is it has, you try getting a manufacturer's degree on anything. That was where Better Place with its battery swap model failed. It couldn't, I mean, manufacturers can barely agree that wheels should be round and make everything else in the car different. And even then the wheels are different diameters, widths, whatever. If they could make them oval or some other shape, I'm sure they would just to differentiate themselves. So I can't see the manufacturers in general doing that. But we are getting down to only a few major groups in the world. And that is, therefore, those platforms being shared. But it doesn't matter whether they're petrol or electric. So you've got the Stellantis group, which is, I'm trying to think of them all. There's just so many. Opel.
Fiat.
Fiat, Chrysler, Dodge. There's about 11 marks under that one. There's the VW group, which has probably more marks. They got
Audi, Skoda.
Audi, Skoda. Porsche. Cupra is a VW brand. Seat is a VW brand. Porsche, all those ones are. You've got the Mercedes group, which is part of, I think Daimler's involved in there. You've got the Renault group, which is Renault, Mitsubishi, Nissan, and someone else I think is lurking around there as well. And they're sort of the four big groups. So they will share platforms, and they already do, but it doesn't matter whether it's petrol or electric, they already are. So it's just part of the way the industry works.
So it's not, we're not going to end up with a major manufacturer such as Bosch, which now supply a lot of the electrical parts to Ford, General Motors, etc., taking over a role, making the basic architecture with the electric motors and supplying it to the auto manufacturers who are just putting bodies on and interiors on and give it some branding to differentiate it.
Won't go to that extent, but they already make most of the ABS systems in the world for all the manufacturers. You know, Bosch do make manufactured parts that are common to a lot of...
Sure, yeah.
So it might not happen, or in fact it won't happen in the whole platform, but it already happens in different parts.
Okay, let's move to the Australian government viewpoint about electric vehicles.
I can think they ruined the long weekend. Oh, hang on, they've left. Sorry.
I can think of a lot of reasons why the Australian government wouldn't want to see a rapid move from petrol vehicles to electric vehicles. I can understand that it's very appealing for a government in terms of voters saying, look, we're a government, we're very green and we want to get around in electric vehicles. But if you're a federal government in Australia, you're making $20.8 billion from a fuel tax each year. That's going to be very hard to replace if you lose that.
Not entirely true, because the Victorian government has already introduced the EV roaders tax, which is basically a replacement per kilometre, and a road user charge, which is a per kilometre charge, has been discussed for many decades, but uncertain how to implement it. And the Victorian government has probably successfully proved how not to implement one, but various other states are going to implement. So that'll replace.
So you see a straight...
That's a straight replacement. We need to pay for roads somehow, and if we're not going to pay it through our petrol, then there would have to be some sort of road user charge.
Okay, I see governments not wanting 352,200 automotive and engineering trade workers lose their jobs, which the Bureau of Statistics in Canberra have said that's what will happen after there are no internal combustion engine cars left.
It's interesting to see what exactly would happen. It was interesting when things moved from horse and cart to petrol cars. All the coach builders, the wheelwrights, all of those people, a lot of them transferred across to building coach bodies. Wheelwrights obviously began with the early cars with wooden, and then they basically faded out. So it's not an instant transition. Some of those skills will be moved across. And electric cars are still two-thirds effectively the same car as what we already have. So they have interiors, they have electrics, they have lights, they have wheels, they have tyres, they have brakes. So all of that part of the automotive industry will still keep going. And as I was at an automotive aftermarket dealers and service and aftermarket parts suppliers conference earlier this year, at which I caught COVID, but that's another story. By the by, it was just the one time that I went out when thinking, I'm not really comfortable going here.
And you knew it was going to happen.
I knew it was going to happen.
You had that feeling.
Yeah, but I needed to go there because there was the Victorian opposition minister was talking and I wanted to hear what he was going to say and write it up.
Right.
I got a good story, but I got COVID as well. Anyway, that's by the by for the podcast. Where was I going with that? The jobs and where it's going. So there's plans in place to try and work out where the new jobs in EVs will be. Dealerships will be an interesting one. Tesla has a model where it doesn't have dealers. And given that the major income for dealers is servicing, most of us, A, tend to avoid dealers for that reason because they charge us through the nose, and B, they may not be profitable anymore. So they'll be going to a agency model. So Honda already basically closed down the dealer network as such and gone to Honda owns all the dealers, and other manufacturers are starting to do that. So they can see the writing on the wall for that part of the industry. But other parts of the industry are just looking at how do we make the move, make the transition.
Okay.
So there will still be people doing, you're still going to do safety checks. Most people are not mechanically minded. They've got other things in their life to do. So they'll still need a service once a year. My Kona has a service once a year or 15,000 Ks. And it's effectively a safety check, which is they walk around, check the brakes, check the tyres, update the software, do any recalls, update the maps, give me another 12-month free roadside assist, and off I go again.
The next on my list of reasons why the government would prefer a slow introduction of EVs is that they are part of a protocol agreement that says we need to keep so much petrol strategically on our shores for national security, of which we've failed dismally at.
Yes.
And
it's probably floating out there or somewhere in the Atlantic.
Our strategic reserve is actually located in the United States, and it's part of their strategic reserve.
Yes.
And to try and address that, the government uses taxpayers' dollars to guarantee the profitability of the petrol refineries in Australia. So if they're on a month-by-month basis, if they don't make enough money, we the taxpayer give them money to ensure that they're profitable.
Till 2030.
Yes, and then the government is encouraging exploration of fossil fuels. At what stage would we strategically not be dependent upon petrol so that we don't have those necessities to subsidise a fossil fuel business?
It depends on how fast you encourage the transition to happen.
And they're not encouraging it very quickly.
The previous government didn't, and the new government's been in for 8 weeks, and they're already talking about moves to speed it up.
Do you think that they will, well, I mean, as a country, we haven't set a date to phase out internal combustion engine vehicles. Most other countries have. Most manufacturers have actually set dates where they've said that they will be all electric. Honda have.
GM have.
GM have. And we should mention also Ballarat resident is now, Trevor Hester, is now the person at General Motors in charge of electric vehicles worldwide, which is a feather in Australia's cap. Do you see the Labor federal government setting a date quite quickly for all electric cars to be sold?
I think it might be a bit of a political hand grenade to do it, and they don't need to, because the rest of the world's going to all electric. As you say, the manufacturers, so they're writing on a wall the setting dates. Jaguar, as another example, is 2025. It will be all electric in all their models. So it's happening quite quickly. So we just won't get the petrol cars sent here. They won't be available. So in some ways, we don't need to set it out. We don't have a manufacturing industry to encourage to make the change. We just import vehicles from overseas. Vehicles from overseas will be electric.
So we won't have any choice.
We won't have any choice. So there's not really, unless you want to buy the older vehicles, and nobody around the world's saying that they'll ban older vehicles. If they exist, they keep going. So people want to keep their old ones going, that's fine. That's harking back to those biofuels that keep the legacy fleet going, classic cars going, that type of thing. But that will be a declining number as cars in those new niches, those new market segments start arriving.
Okay, now we get to the fun part of the podcast, where you being my expert on electric vehicles have to encapsulate the concept of electric vehicles and convert it into a hamburger, which is called the Burgonomics test.
Mm.
So what I want to ask you is, if we have a fully electric vehicle society, what difference is that going to make to our simple hamburger?
I'll go back a step and say, how do we change from the hamburger that we currently have to the electric vehicle hamburger?
Okay.
And the point of which is, the hamburger itself is still a hamburger. Not all of it changes. We still start off with a hamburger with a meat patty, and then we finish with a hamburger with a meat-free patty. And it's the transition between those two that we're talking about. Ultimately, the meat-free patty is better for the environment, will be tasting just as good as the meat patty, but there's a whole lot of research and development and people involved in spending money to come up with the perfect meat patty, sorry, meat-free patty, to become the new hamburger. And that's the transition that we're in at the moment. It's not that we have to keep going with the meat patty all the way through. People will prefer the meat-free patty because it's just overall a better burger, but it's how do we get there?
Great analogy. Thank you. Now, the last question, and you and I may disagree on this, which is...
I'll be a bit of a devil's advocate on this one, because I know that economics has a broader context.
Why is the economist the hero in the electric vehicle story?
I tend to think of them as the enemy in some ways, because they tend to look at the holy dollar and we keep doing what we do well and stay doing it and resist change. And you could look at the legacy car manufacturers. They have fought really hard to not build electric cars, because that means money spent that they have to put into the new manufacturing and laying off workers. So that's a change, and it's always been in the past, in a disruptive transition, the legacy people lose. So they're fighting really hard and using the economic arguments and a whole lot of others to effectively lie about the change in order to maintain that status quo. And I sort of see economics as, if only focus on the dollar, that looks good, but it's also brought us to the situation where we have massive climate change, massive inequality in the world, massive unhappiness in the world, because they don't measure those things. But I take it back a little bit, because economists should be broader than that, and the new federal Labor finance minister is actually bringing in, as part of the budget process, a measure of human happiness, I think it is, or something like that, as part of the budget process. If it broadens, that's good. At the moment, economists, I think most people view them as the people that turn the dollar into the holy dollar, and morality and everything else goes out the window. So, over to you.
I have to stick up for economists.
Yes. I was being a devil's advocate.
I have to do that, because my view is, in terms of electric vehicles, it's the economists that have said the climate is changing for the worst. There is a bad human cost coming to us very quickly. And whereas economists would usually say, let market principles determine where we go, they're not saying that with electric vehicles. They're saying electric vehicles are very important to reduce our emissions. And I think vehicles in Australia produce around 11% of our carbon emissions.
It's about 19%, I think.
19.
Or that's all transport, but it's heavy transport cars. Right, passenger vehicles might be 11.
And so they've said this is not acceptable, and they're encouraging government, unsuccessfully so far in Australia, to subsidise electric vehicles, to put them in more garages, in more homes, to reduce emissions. So I see them being at the absolute coalface of change, because they're the ones that have really told government, no, this isn't an economic argument per se, it's a human habitat argument, and you need to intervene.
Yeah, my point was that economists are viewed as, they don't look at that side of the equation. So it sounds really more the devil's advocate, because I think the common person's perception of an economist is seeing it as they focus on the dollar and not the broader picture. If they're focusing on a broader picture, and I know that some of them do with carbon accounting, I do a 5-yearly carbon account of electric vehicles driven on the grid in Australia, and that is slowly improving. You can watch the grid improve and the electric vehicle improves with it, which is good, and which is something that the internal combustion engine car could never do. But it's just that tension, I suppose, between what people think of economists as the dollar only and the broader context of when will economics become seen as a broader context, or it should be, and probably is by many in niche areas of it, but when will it take over the full thinking of economy? So you have the environment, you have people's happiness, you have equality and morality all built into economics. Or are they now and it's just we don't notice?
Economics is not a science, but a social science, Bryce, and a lot of people forget the social side of it. So it does exist. Thank you very much for coming today. You've exploded a lot of myths about electric vehicles, because there are a lot of myths out there and you must come across them on a daily basis, and they must annoy the hell out of you.
They do. It didn't help with the EVs being added to the climate war by the previous federal election. That frustrated me no end. It was just they didn't deserve to be so trolled effectively by calling me out, ruining a long weekend, stealing a trade issue, all rubbish. And as part of that transition, these things will improve all the time. So I mean, when they ruined the long weekend came about, I drove around Victoria, 2,400 kilometres, 7 days, no DC charging at that stage. It was a crazy long weekend because nobody would do that sort of distance in that short a time. But I proved that it was easy. There was no problem in an electric car. And I went Melbourne, Bairnsdale, over Mount Hotham, up to Mildura, back down to Geelong, and around. It was just, yes, you could do it even then, even when it was said they would ruin the long weekend.
Right, okay.
And the tradies ute is pretty much on the horizon, perhaps by the end of this year. Rivian is already building them in America. Ford F-150 Lightning is so oversubscribed that their production for the next several years is booked out. They're trying to increase, but they've doubled and then doubled again the production schedule, and they're trying to work out how to do it again.
That's the great problem though, isn't it? In terms of, we do want to transition, we've got to get the vehicles to transition. Mm. And at the moment, those vehicles aren't available, a lot of them.
Yeah, our vehicle world has become so broad and so niched in a way. There's just you know, there's the four-wheel drive ute, there's the four-wheel drive SUV, there's the ladder frame Land Cruiser, you know, the real off-road country versions. There's just so many different things. You know, the little Buzzbox passenger car, you know, little VW Ups, or there is in fact an E-Up in Europe, things like that. It's just, there's so many different cars now that they've all got to slowly become EV.
And available.
Yes.
And maybe the government doesn't need to set a date, because it would be ridiculous anyway to set a date to go all electric, because it's about supply.
Yes, but the key point is we need a government, or federal government, that need to set a direction so all the states will paddle in the same direction. I've used the analogy before of, think of Australia as 8 states and territories, so a rowing 8, but a coxswain, the federal government, fell overboard. So all the states are paddling madly in what they think is the right direction for promoting EV sales and uptake, and effectively working against each other until we get a federal direction saying, this is the rough direction, can you all paddle roughly that way, please? That's part of the problem here.
Let's hope it changes quickly. Mm. Bryce, thank you very much.
Yep, you're welcome.
Okay.
It's been a fun time.
My thanks to Bryce Gatton for being my expert guest on the Electric Vehicle Bergonomics podcast. You can find Bryce at evchoice.com.au. My 3 key takeaway points from Bryce were: 100% of our global society will be driving electric vehicles. The when part of the equation is when the economies of scale reduce the purchase price of EVs so that every income group can afford them. The second point was, today it is substantially cheaper to run an electric vehicle than a petrol vehicle. And thirdly, anyone's apprehension about electric vehicles will reduce to zero as more are introduced onto our roads. If you want to delve deeper into electric vehicles, Bryce recommends 2 websites. Firstly, the Australian Electric Vehicle Association website at aeva.asn.au, which has electric vehicle fact sheets, and thedriven.io. Hopefully, I'll be able to change Bryce's negative view of economists. Certainly all economists need to wake up that not everybody has positive views about economics, and we need to change that. jump on our Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, or Facebook feeds with your opinion. My thanks to Ology Creative, the brains behind the design elements of Bergonomics. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast and follow Bergonomics on your favourite social media channel. Thanks for listening.